Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Eliza Griswold, the author of The Tenth Parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Lines Between Christianity and Islam. We'll discuss sectarian violence along the Christian-Muslim divide that is exploding in Nigeria, Sudan, and the Philippines as conflicts over religion, nationhood, and natural resources threaten to remake the world in the coming years. Then we'll talk with economist Dean Baker about his new e-book, The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. We'll discuss the willingness of progressives to accept the conservative framing of political debates, where conservatives like the market while liberals like the government, which puts liberals in a position of seeming to want to tax the winners to help the losers. Then finally, we will challenge the recent prediction on the cover of Time magazine that Europe is about to collapse. Stephen Hill, the author of Europe's Promise, Why the European Way is the Best Hope for an Insecure Age, joins us. We'll explore the paradox that while we are told Europeans are facing bankruptcy, they nevertheless enjoy a higher standard of living than we do and continue to enjoy social services we can only dream of. Joining us now is Eliza Griswold, author of the new award-winning book, The Tenth Parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Lines Between Christianity and Islam. She is both a reporter and a poet who writes widely on religion, conflict, and human rights, and she's currently a senior fellow at the New America Foundation. Her first book, a collection of poems called Wide Awake Field, received the 2010 Rome Prize from the American Academy in Rome. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eliza Griswold.
Thank you for having me.
Eliza, of course, there was a bombing in Nigeria that connected to sectarian fault lines. I've talked a lot to people in the new country of southern Sudan who've been on the border, human rights monitors, etc. There's been decades of religious, ethnic, and racial violence there. Give us a sense of how much religion between the fault line, the 10th parallel, as you write about, between Christianity and Islam is driving all of these subnational and transnational wars.
So religion plays a role in many of these conflicts along the 10th parallel, and we're really looking at the space between the equator and the line of latitude 700 miles to the north, the 10th parallel, across much of inland Africa and across Asia. And the reason that religion comes in, especially in Africa, we see this as something people fight about, has a lot to do with the fact that, and you touched on this with both Sudan and Nigeria, these are extremely weak states, you know, drawn by colonial administrators on maps. These lines never meant much to anyone. And in many of the places, and this is certainly true in Nigeria and Sudan, the state has traditionally been weak at best, rapacious at worst. And so for both your average Nigerian and your average person in southern Sudan, different forms of identity come to the fore. And even more than ethnicity, race, or really even tribe, religion becomes the most important common denominator.
But Eliza, these states may be poor, but they're rich in resources, Nigeria being oil, and Sudan, by the way, is sitting on a lot of oil, with the paradox, of course, that the pipelines go through the north, whereas the fields are in the south in this new country.
Exactly right. So, you know, Nigeria is America's fifth largest supplier of oil, and the most populous country in Africa, and yet more than half of its population lives on $1 to $2 a day. And that enormous gap between rich and poor, which we're seeing emerge more profoundly here in the United States as well, but that leads people to a Nigerian cannot turn to his government to safeguard. He doesn't get a free education. He doesn't get clean water. He doesn't get a good road. He doesn't get electricity. To get those things, particularly in the Middle Belt, particularly in the towns we're talking about along the 10th parallel, you turn to your local imam or your local pastor. You become part of a group to advocate for your communal rights, and that communal identity is usually religion.
So it seems, though, that in spite of how these sectarian struggles are igniting that you've written about, Eliza Griswold, in the 10th parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Lines Between Christianity and Islam, there also seems to be intra-religious fault lines. I've been speaking a lot with specialists on the Middle East, talking about the emerging Sunni-Shia divide. And as you know, the Shia Iranian regime is supporting the minority Shia regime in Syria against the majority Sunni, and there's a rivalry between the Sunni kings and the theocratic regime in Tehran that's trying to spread its influence in what is called the Shia Crescent. And the impression one gets is that this is a tinderbox.
Indeed. In fact, I'd say after 7 years of traveling along this fault line where, you know, more than half of the world's Muslims meet more than half of the world's Christians, the most overarching conclusion I could draw and do draw in the book is that the most important religious struggles of our times are those inside of religions, not between them. They're the struggles between Muslims and Muslims, as you were talking about, or Christians and Christians, over who has the right to speak for God and why. In particular, you were talking about Boko Haram. That's the group, which means loosely Western education forbidden. Then they are from a place called Maiduguri in northern Nigeria. This is the group that attacked a UN building in Abuja, which lies almost smack along the 10th parallel. And I actually had an unfortunate run-in that I don't write much about in the book because I didn't write about sort of the hairier adventures very much. But I was actually attacked, along with photographer Seamus Murphy, by a mob of these guys. They also call themselves Nigerian Taliban. Okay, so they attacked our car. We were almost killed. And much more importantly, our translator really almost lost his life. We were able to get out of that situation by sheer luck. But what that means, I mean, why did this group attack us, and what do they represent? Well, they represent exactly that fissure inside of Islam that is extraordinarily fraught between what people on the ground, what West Africans might call Arab Islam. They mean what we are more familiar with as Salafia or more traditional Islam in a kind of violence, because, of course, most North Africans are Sufis. And Islam arrived in North Africa through intermarriage and through trade. And probably one of the single most important statistics that got me started on this book was the fact that 4 out of 5 of the world's 1.6 billion Muslims don't live in the Middle East. They're not Arabs. They live in Africa and they live in Asia. And this is the place they meet Christianity. And those are the current concerns inside of Islam that are particularly relevant today to their relationship actually with the West.
So given the experience you had with, you know, a near-death experience in Nigeria, and I take it at the hands of the Salafists or the Wahhabis, which is a sort of alien, you know, particularly, as you mentioned, in the Sufi areas, nevertheless, it's growing in influence because of the petrodollars pumped into it by the Saudis, who have been propagating this form of Islam for decades. And you know, frankly, I often wonder, you know, we call the Saudis our friends, but, you know, given the export of Wahhabism to Afghanistan that created the Taliban, given what's happening in Pakistan, which is teetering on becoming a failed state, and what you've witnessed in West Africa, maybe we should reevaluate our relationship.
Certainly in regard to, and this is probably one of the most powerful and underreported stories actually happening today, in West Africa, in Nigeria alone, there are roughly 23 million young people, young Muslims, who go to exactly what you're talking about, the madrasas that the Saudi Arabia funded primarily in Pakistan that certainly has given rise to the Taliban. There are the same kind of schooling happens in West Africa. And this is one of those weird lines in which climate change actually plays a role in hardening religious lines, because there are these vast numbers, 23 million in Nigeria alone. So in West Africa, that number is probably quadruple, although I'm always suspicious of figures. But these guys travel to go to school. They go to their Islamic education for free. And what's happening is they used to be educated for free. These are called al-Majri youth. They just mean madrasa students. They used to be educated for free because they went to farms, essentially. So in exchange for learning, traditional Islamic learning, and the teaching was very, very good in many of these schools, they did farming for the teachers. Well, what's happening as a result of climate change and the increasing creep of the desert in West Africa is that these teachers can no longer sustain farms. They move to slums. They move to the edge of Abuja. And I write about this in the book. They moved to the edge of Abuja, and the kids who used to pay for their schooling by farming now pay for their schooling by begging. And it's these young people who are absolutely recruited for Boko Haram and all other kinds of nefarious activities. So there isn't a lot of Saudi funding in terms of these kind of schools yet, but this certainly points to exactly the same problem that we saw in Pakistan, where a lack of education and a lack of resources leads to a radicalized population.
Well, Eliza, I feel that we need to revisit this subject, have a subsequent conversation, because we've run out of time. But I'd love to get more of your poet sensibility in terms of being a journalist. And it certainly comes across in your new book, The Tenth Parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Line Between Christianity and Islam.
Thanks a lot, Ian.
And thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Eliza Griswold, the author of the new award-winning book, The Tenth Parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Lines Between Christianity and Islam. We'll take a brief station break and be back talking with economist Dean Baker.
What did Washington say to his troops as they crossed the Delaware? I'm sure you're well aware.
What'd they say?
We can do it. We can do it. We can do it, me and you. We can do it. We can do it. We can make our dreams come true. Everything you've ever wanted.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Dean Baker, who is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank based in Washington, D.C. His books include Taking Economics Seriously, False Prophets, Recovering from the Bubble Economy, and The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer. He also writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press. His latest e-book is The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dean Baker.
Thanks for having me on.
And I take it the theme of your new e-book, The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive, is essentially that progressives have accepted the conservatives' framing of political debates and the framing that conservatives like the market while liberals like the government puts liberals in a position of seeming to want to tax the winners to help the losers.
Exactly. So the implication is that somehow, you know, we just had this distribution of income, you know, we rolled the die and, you know, it turned out Bill Gates and Pete Peterson, these people came out on top, and then, you know, other people didn't do very well. And now we're out there saying, well, we don't really like that, so we want to tax the winners and hand it to the losers. And, you know, I don't mind saying, I don't like that. I don't like that distribution of income. But the key point is that it doesn't matter what I like or don't like. It wasn't just that we rolled the dice. They rigged the deck. And we're ignoring the fact that they rigged the deck. So if we just play the game, if we just have our political debates from the standpoint that everything was fair, but we just don't like the way, you know, the way the market outcomes turned out, we put ourselves at an enormous disadvantage, both politically and also in policy terms.
So, in other words, we got to get over this ridiculous debate over President Clinton's tax increase and President Bush's reversal with his massive tax cuts. It's not about tax cuts for the rich. It's a systemic problem that goes back to Reagan.
Exactly. And, you know, it's I'd love to, you know, the rich can pay more taxes. I mean, that's, you know, so I'm not disputing that. I don't think the tax cuts on the rich aren't fair or they're onerous or this and that. I mean, we've had much, much higher tax rates on the wealthy. But the far more important issue is the upward redistribution of before-tax income. So, you know, I made some comment somewhere that we're kind of, this is the kids' table at Thanksgiving dinner. We're focused on, you know, this tax rate. There's like $50 billion a year at stake in the taxes on the upper 2%, whereas we're talking about literally trillions that have been redistributed in terms of income each year from those at the middle and bottom to those in the top 10%, particularly at the top 1%. So we're kind of, you know, focused on the wrong, you know, the lesser part of the story when we just talk about taxes.
So walk us through the elements then that make up this systemic problem as opposed to the one that gets all the headlines and the attention about the tax rates of billionaires, which you point out will only bring the Treasury $50 billion a year extra as opposed to the trillions that are out there being maldistributed.
Well, there's a variety of different factors that, you know, led to this upper redistribution of income. Some of it, a big factor, was weakening unions. It's quite deliberate policy the Reagan administration put in effect, you know, after he took office, made it much more difficult to organize, made it much more difficult to strike. One of the big stories, we just passed the 30th anniversary of the PATCO strike, the air traffic controllers. And, of course, he fired the air traffic controllers. And that was something that was pretty much unprecedented, that people would actually lose their jobs for going out on strike. It was a rare employer that would literally fire their striking workers and hire replacement workers. And that became standard practice in the 80s. And that, again, was conscious design, weaken the power of unions. People think that we're looking to the government to protect workers. No. The government, it comes down a very heavy hand if workers engage in strikes that are in violation of the National Labor Relations Law. So what we have is a situation where employers violate labor relations law all the time. They fire workers when they're trying to organize. Absolute standard practice in the textbook of good management. Whereas if unions violate labor law, they pay heavy fines. The officers go to prison. That's what happened with the PATCO strike. The officers were actually locked up, put behind bars. So it's not a question of why the government intervened. The question is, how does the government intervene? Trade policy. We quite deliberately adopted the trade policy that put our manufacturing workers in direct competition with low-paid laborers all over the world. So our auto workers in Detroit have to compete with workers that get paid maybe a tenth as much in Mexico and China and other countries. That was absolutely conscious policy. We didn't do the same with doctors and lawyers. Those are highly paid professionals protected from foreign competition. A high dollar, an overvalued dollar, this is a conscious policy of the Clinton administration after Robert Rubin took over as Treasury Secretary. An overvalued dollar, in effect, subsidizing imports and putting a tariff on exports. That makes it even harder for our manufacturing workers to compete. That, in effect, puts downward pressure on the wages of manufacturing workers, and I should say more generally, the 70% of the workforce that doesn't have college degrees, to the benefit of, you know, the higher-end workers. Too big to fail banks. You know, we have J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs, all these very large banks that, in effect, operate with an implicit insurance policy from the government. So they can take big risks, get big profits. When they lose, taxpayers bail them out. So there's a series of ways which we could identify in which the government is coming to the aid of those at the top end of the wealth distribution, penalizing those at the middle and bottom.
And you have to add to that, of course, patent protection, right?
Patent protection is hugely important. I focus on prescription drugs just because it's such a clear-cut case, and there is a lot of money at stake. We spend roughly $300 billion a year on prescription drugs, and the incredible part of the story is they would be cheap. Drugs would be very cheap without patent protection, without a government-guaranteed monopoly. Most drugs are very cheap to produce. You can go to chain retail stores and buy most drugs for $4 or $5 a prescription. That's what they would all cost if we didn't have the government intervening, giving Pfizer, Merck, and the other big pharmaceutical companies monopolies. So here it is, we're talking about somewhere on the order of $250, $270 billion a year in extra money that gets handed to the pharmaceutical companies that never really gets raised as an issue. Instead, we're yelling about the $50 billion in the Bush tax cuts.
So Dean Baker, again, the author of this new e-book, The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. So this is a really a kind of it's not so much a battle cry, it's a battle plan that you're laying out here.
Well, I hope to. I mean, you know, it's at least to my mind an outline of the issues that need to be raised. I'm sure there's many, many more. I mean, some I can identify that I even talk about in the book. And, you know, the issues that I do raise, I can't say I have, like, you know, how do you go from where we are today to victory. But the point is we have to at least get these issues on the table, because as it stands now, you know, the best case story, okay, let's say, let's envision that we get President Obama reelected in 2012 and he has enough support in Congress. We get the Bush tax cuts, you know, expiring at the end of 2012. You know, that's okay, but this is not the world I think any of us envision living in. So we have to talk about how you shift the debate in a very fundamental way.
And given that the Republicans now are referring to billionaires, now you've made the point that if we continue to fight more and more rounds over the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy, we're going to get nowhere. We're missing the big picture. But it does seem that, you know, when you talk about framing, the conservatives are now, you know, they've been pretty clever in the way they frame things. But I'm not sure about how clever it is to refer to billionaires as job creators, which is the latest kind of Republican talking point. Do you think that Obama's strategy of trying to, which of course he lost in the debt ceiling crisis, which was manufactured by the Republicans, he tried to shame them by saying that, you know, all you cared about is tax cuts for corporate jets and not for the working man. Is that working somewhere in America? Because I just wonder at times whether people in this country truly have, you know, been bought this bill of goods that your economic destiny is tied up with the freedom of tax of the very wealthy not to pay taxes.
I think President Obama probably is doing pretty well on that. I mean, the polls typically show him doing a lot better than Congress in the debate over the debt ceiling. And, you know, as a practical matter, I don't think there's a lot of people that buy the argument that if we had somewhat higher taxes on the rich, you know, where you cut that off is a debating point. But, you know, if you had a higher tax on the rich, that would be very harmful. I think what is the concern that they, you know, I think they exploited it somewhat effectively. Of course, President Obama won the election. But, you know, when you go back to 2008, they were running around with Joe the Plumber saying, no, he's not going to tax the rich. He's Joe the Plumber. The whole point was, he was Joe Everyman as a guy that's not rich, quite explicitly not rich. And, you know, there's a lot of untruth to that because, of course, President Obama wasn't talking about taxing him more. But I think that's the concern. People believe that, oh, yeah, they're saying they're going to tax the rich, but they really want to tax, you know, the ordinary person. So I think that could be a winning line for the Republicans if they can convince people that's true. I don't know to what extent they have thus far.
Well, I understand that there's a Republican proposal in the House to end the moratorium or the holiday on the payroll tax. In other words, to reinstate the payroll tax, which is a regressive tax, effectively taxing people for having a job.
Well, you know, the Democrats have made a big issue of this. I'm not sure that that's very clever because we do need that money for Social Security. So I don't, you know, we don't need it this year. And, of course, the plan is that Social Security is going to be credited with that money regardless. So the idea is that, you know, instead of having this come from the payroll tax, you'll have it come from general revenue, which, you know, is fine if there's a consensus for that and we can keep going like that. But there isn't really. I mean, no one argued for that being an ongoing way to finance the program. So the program has historically been funded by the payroll tax. This was a departure from it in 2011 where we did have this tax holiday, a 2 percentage point reduction in the payroll tax, and made up for it with general revenue. President Obama wants to continue that in 2012. That's okay. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say that's a bad thing, but it does raise issues about the future of the program. And if the Democrats think it's really clever to say, oh, we can't raise that, that's a tax on, you know, Joe working stiff, well, that's really not clever because we do need that money for Social Security at some point. So unless they could somehow guarantee that we're going to get that money from general revenue, and guarantees from the Democrats have not been worth very much lately, I really don't think that's a terribly clever strategy.
Again, I'm speaking with Dean Baker, who's the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. His latest e-book is The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. And this book is free, right?
Yes. People can download it from our website, CEPR, www.ceper.net. So it's totally free.
So as we approach the next year, the election year, it's a sort of truism, Dean Baker, that politicians hate to run in a bad economy, and that President Obama really has an albatross around his neck, as do the Democrats. And you've got people like Rick Perry, who's now the Republican frontrunner, out there talking about jobs, these so-called Texas miracle. So just to accept that notion, it really is the economy stupid, as Jim Carville said, right, that people simply don't have a very sophisticated understanding about how we got into this economic mess, who's dug the hole deeper, which arguably the Republicans just did with this debt ceiling deal. That none of that washes, right? People just are sort of irrationally angry at the situation and they strike out at whoever's in power.
Well, that's been the history. And, you know, if he has to run for re-election with an unemployment rate that's almost certain to be over 8% and quite possibly over 9%, that's going to be really hard. That's not to say he's going to lose. He's a very effective politician, very, you know, charismatic speaker. You know, the Republicans are going to raise a lot of questions. A lot of people are going to be scared by, you know, certainly if the Republican nominee is Rick Perry. So President Obama may still win in that context. But historically, it's been the case. People hold the party in power responsible, party votes the White House responsible for the state of the economy.
So do you think that the president, he's going to lay out this jobs program, but I have a feeling that's going to fall flat because there's simply no way that he can ever implement it with the obstructionist Republicans. So what about him laying out the plan that you've just laid out? The end of loser liberalism, making markets progressive.
Yeah, well, I would love to see that. Unfortunately, I don't think it's terribly likely because he's got two things going on. One is he wants to get votes, but the other thing he's very conscious of is he has to get campaign contributions. They've set a target of raising over $1 billion for the reelection campaign, and you're not going to get that from, you know, going to Joe Working Stiff, Joe and Jane Working Stiff. So he wants to appease, you know, the business community, and for that he's trying very hard to be very business friendly. And the idea that he's really going to turn in some fundamental way and adopt policies that are designed to reverse the upward redistribution of the last three decades, I can't think of anything that will get the business community more angry. So I think that likely is a winning agenda with the public at large. But when you're going out raising campaign contributions, that's probably not the line you want to pitch.
So do you think, Dean Baker, that the president has been disadvantaged because of the weakness of his economic team? Not that too many people say good things about the people that led it, Larry Summers, et cetera, Tim Geithner. But he's lost Christine Romer. And now he's lost Austin Goolsbee, who never impressed me. In fact, Fox News has been playing an interview that Sean Hannity did with Goolsbee, you know, as a way to show how much Hannity could lacerate the liberal, you know. What do you think of this new guy that's filling the breach?
Well, Alan Krueger is a very smart guy in terms of, you know, who he might plausibly have picked. I mean, I could think of, you know, I'd love to see Joe Stiglitz there, you know, Nobel Prize-winning economist, Paul Krugman, another Nobel Prize-winning economist, columnist for the Times, of course, New York Times. I'd love to see those people there, but I knew that wasn't in the cards. So given the list of people who I thought he might pick, I think Alan Krueger is a good person, a smart guy, and relatively, you know, liberal, progressive. He's known, his first important work was showing that increases in the minimum wage do not lead to job loss. So, you know, in the scheme of things, I think it's a good pick. Now, does that mean we're going to see any big change in policy? No. I mean, I'd be shocked if, you know, I doubt Alan would push for anything that big. And even if he did, I don't think he's going to be able to overrule the political people. And for that matter, I think Timothy Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, carries probably more weight than anyone in economic policy right now. And Geithner, of course, is very close to Wall Street. So I consider him, in the scheme of things, a relatively good pick, but does it lead me to think anything's going to change? No, not at all.
Well, that's often the case, though, isn't it, that the chief economist in the White House takes a back seat to the Secretary of Treasury? At least that happened. You just mentioned Joe Stiglitz. He was effectively shut out during the Clinton administration by Robert Rubin, who was the Secretary of Treasury.
That's right, Stiglitz, and you also had Robert Reich arguing for a more progressive position. So both are, as Secretary of Labor, of course.
Right.
So it tends to be Secretary of Treasury tends to be the most important economic post, and you know, you don't expect it's hard to envision someone coming in as head of the Council of Economic Advisers and really changing the course of an administration.
So just to broaden this landscape a little bit, from your new ebook, Dean Baker, The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive, when you talk about loser liberalism, there seems to be a kind of reflex on the American left to expect to lose. And you know, there's been a history of the liberals getting irritated and abandoning. They abandoned Humphrey in 68 and helped elect Nixon. They abandoned Carter for Teddy Kennedy in the primary, and then for John Anderson, another Republican, total phony as far as I could tell, in the general. That helped elect Reagan, and because Nader helped elect Bush in 2000, and so on. So do you think that there is clearly there's a lack of strategy on the left, if that's the record, but how would you describe this phenomenon that it seems to be, where the left in this country would rather be righteous than effective, whereas the right don't care about intellectual inconsistencies, they're just determined to win?
Well, the right is playing hardball, and the left just hasn't been. Now, you know, the right comes with enormous advantages. I mean, you know, these are the rich people in the country. These are people that control the media to a very large extent. They control universities to a very large extent. I mean, they have enormous control, enormous power in ways that the left doesn't. But I think, you know, there literally is no effort on the left to have a coherent strategy. And, you know, one of the things I look back to, you go, you know, as much as I don't approve of what they were doing, it's hard not to admire how effective they were. So you go, okay, well, what did Reagan do when he came in office? Well, he saw the unions generally support Democrats, generally support progressive causes. Wipe them out. He didn't just win an election. He wanted to wipe them out. And to a large extent, private sector unions, when he came in office, they're 20% of the workforce. Today, they're about 7%. He looked at legal aid. Legal aid lawyers were going around defending poor people, filing class action suits against government, against corporations. He said, well, guess what? You can't do that anymore. Legal aid lawyers couldn't file class action suits. They could, you know, file suits someone, you know, who's having their security deposit held by a landlord wrongly, things like that. They couldn't do anything that might be seen as a political suit. He cut back funding for National Public Radio. He gave them a clear message. You're going to be more conservative or you're going to lose more funding. National Endowment of the Arts, same thing. So they're very systematic in looking at all the bases of support for progressive politics of any type and attack them. So it wasn't just a question of winning an election. They wanted to destroy any base of progressivism. And, you know, we couldn't do the same. It's not that we have the same levers of power that they do, but we're not even thinking in those terms. They were thinking, how do we make sure not that just President Reagan gets reelected in 1984, but we permanently change the terms of the debate, and they succeeded.
Well, Dean Baker, I thank you for joining us. And again, your new ebook, The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive, available at
www.cepr.net.
And it's one of the few things that are free nowadays, right?
That's right. Absolutely free.
Well, I thank you again.
Thanks for having me on.
I've been speaking with Dean Baker, who is the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank based in Washington, D.C. His books include Taking Economics Seriously, False Profits, Recovering from the Bubble Economy, and The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer. He also writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press. His latest ebook is The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about predictions that Europe is about to collapse. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Stephen Hill, who is a writer, columnist, and former director of the Political Reform Program at the New America Foundation. His books include 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy, Fixing Elections, The Failure of America's Winner-Take-All Politics, and Whose Vote Counts, written with his friend Rob Ritchie. His latest book is Europe's Promise, Why the European Way is the Best Hope for an Insecure Age. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Hill.
My pleasure, Ian.
And just a week ago, Time magazine had a cover story captioned boldly, The Decline and Fall of Europe. So last time I checked, that Europeans weren't doing so badly. I know there's been a lot of concern in the last few months about the debt contagion in the south with Greece, Italy, Spain, Portugal, and I guess to the West Island. But since that cover came out, it seems like things have settled down. So I wanted to get you to address that disconnect between the apocalyptic sense that Europe's finished and the fact that it seems to be business as usual.
Yeah, I mean, this is a long pattern of American journalism, magazines like Time, Newsweek, as well as the New York Times, Washington Post, for years. I mean, I have, in my book, Europe's Promise, I have a whole bunch of headlines I collected from the 1990s and the early 2000s in which they predicted the decline and fall of Europe. In fact, Fareed Zakaria in February 2006 had an editorial in the Washington Post. And what was the title of that editorial? The Decline and Fall of Europe. So it seems that Europe has declined and fallen quite a few times over the last couple of decades, according to American media outlets. And yet there's Europe still with, you know, everyone in Europe, even in a place like Greece, has health care. People have retirement pensions. People have more vacation, paid sick leave, paid parental leave after they have a child. These things have not gone away in Europe just because Europe is having some economic difficulties in some of the southern countries like Portugal, Greece, and Spain, and Ireland. And in fact, I wrote an article not that long ago saying that, you know, if you look at the rest of Europe, if people weren't so obsessed on the so-called pigs, you actually find that Europe is doing quite well. 14 of the 23 European countries that are members of the OECD, and I use their unemployment rates because they have harmonized rates, but 14 of the 23 European countries in the OECD have lower unemployment rates than the United States does, including Germany, Sweden, Italy, for example, lower unemployment than we have in the United States. The Czech Republic, Netherlands, Belgium, the UK even. France, which often gets skewered for its economic failings, has about the same unemployment rate that we do. So it's just not giving a full picture to simply say that Europe is declining and falling because of the plight of four countries that together make up about 8% of the overall Europe GDP. I mean, they make up far less of a percentage of Europe's GDP than California does of the U.S. GDP, and in California, we have the second highest unemployment rate in the nation. So there's just a lot of context missing from this editorializing reportage, and there's a lot of big picture that's just being completely left out, as they have always done in Europe, with the type of reportage that we've seen from American news sources for many, many years.
And of course, Stephen Hill, there's no mention of what you were just saying in our press, not even next door, where in Canada they have health care. Is there a sense that the Canadians next door have a higher standard of living? We're more or less told that these people are suffering. But what's a stark contrast is, as bad as the news has been out of Europe, what you're saying is that the people are still living a better life and a higher standard of living. But conversely here, we're being told to embrace austerity, which is proving to be a failure in Europe, and that the price that we must pay is to get rid of what little social services we have in the form of Social Security and Medicare.
But I think at this point it's comparing apples and oranges. The European system is just so different from the American system that what is in fact austerity here doesn't have the same effect there. And the reason why is because Europe has basically, they have what I call social capitalism, and I compare that to what we have, which is Wall Street capitalism. And social capitalism is better at sharing the wealth and sharing the prosperity so that more people benefit from the wealth of your society. And it's also better at spreading the pain around when you have economic downtime. So, I mean, nations being in debt, not paying their bills and such is an issue that has to be addressed at some point. The question is, do you do it in the short term or in the long term? And Europe is, for many of the countries, they're saying, we're going to address this debt now because we're able to deal with the pain of this economic downturn in a place like Germany, where the unemployment rate now is actually lower than it was before the economic crisis hit us in 2008. So they're now addressing their debt issues, but of course it's being termed as austerity, and yet in Germany, people have health care. You're not seeing the cutbacks like they're proposing in Medicare and Social Security. They're able to deal with their debt without having to resort to these drastic means. In the U.S., our economy, our Wall Street capitalism, is basically a trickle-down economy. It's not an economy that has the institutions and values to allow us to spread both the prosperity around in the good years or the pain in the bad years. Instead, all the money goes into the pockets of the wealthy. I mean, my latest stand you on your toes factoid is the 400 wealthiest Americans now have $1.4 trillion in wealth, which is as much as the entire economy of the country of India with a billion people. We're talking about vast inequality here in the United States that's just gotten greater as a result of this economic collapse. And in addition, when you look at, well, where do we spend our wealth? There's two things that don't get discussed very much that stand out if you're objective and look at it, say, from the planet Mars. We spend a huge amount of money on our military budget that Europeans and others, Japan and other countries, don't spend, that we can't afford anymore, and we spend twice as much money per capita on health care as all these other countries. And those two things over time are going to bankrupt our country. And so when you talk about should we have stimulus or austerity, and some people like Paul Krugman has said we need more stimulus, which in a way we do, but even more than more stimulus, we're already getting all sorts of stimulus from our ongoing spending in the military budget. We're spending trillions of dollars to keep 700 bases going around the world. We're spending trillions of dollars to employ soldiers that are spending money in other people's economies instead of here. We're not spending that money instead on infrastructure upkeep and maintenance, roads, ports, highways, and airports and such things, which the Army Corps of Engineers has said we're trillions of dollars behind. And so there actually is stimulus money already in our economy, but it's poorly spent. It's inefficient from an economic stimulus standpoint. And so I think that I would rather see people like Paul Krugman and others start talking about not just should we spend more, but what are we already spending our money on? And are we really spending in an efficient and cost-effective way? Because there's all sorts of studies that economists have made that show that when you spend money domestically instead of internationally, and you spend it on infrastructure upkeep and maintenance instead of on things like building weapons and bombs and employing soldiers in other countries, you're going to get more of the multiplier effect. It's going to have a bigger repercussion throughout your economy, and yet we're not getting any of that. And probably in the post-World War II era, when we were the dominant power in the world, we could afford these types of inefficiencies in our economy, because we just, we just economically, militarily, we were so dominant. But now that we live in a much more multipolar, multilateral world, we can't afford these economic inefficiencies anymore. And yet, virtually no one in Washington, D.C. is talking about these things.
Again, I'm speaking with Stephen Hill, who's the author of Europe's Promise, Why the European Way is the best hope for an insecure age. And we're talking about the cover story in Time magazine just a week ago that predicted the downfall of Europe, the decline and fall of Europe, and in by extension the West. And we're talking about how that simply doesn't stand up to the test of reality in terms of the standard of living in Europe. But what about, though, in terms of the banks? I mean, the bondholders of the banks are the ones in Europe that are getting bailed out. The money that goes to Greece doesn't go to the Greek people. They're expected to tighten their belts. The money goes to the bondholders. And now when they talk about Italy and Spain, the third and fourth biggest economies, being not so much too big to fail but too big to bail, where does it stand in terms of the relationship with the European people and their through their governance system and the bondholders, as opposed to here, where you clearly the taxpayer bailed out Wall Street and got nothing in return? And I mean, effectively, we're in an oligarchy here because the political because of our money politics. There's no question of who runs America now. It's Wall Street. But who runs Europe? Do the bankers still have the same kind of an influence there that they have here?
I don't think so. No, I think in each country that's having debt problems, Greece, Spain, Ireland, and Portugal, their situations are not exactly the same. And Greece, it's unfortunately that some ways that Greece has become the poster child of this situation because Greece really does have problems with spending more than it makes. Spain, on the other hand, in terms of its government, before the economic collapse in 2008, which was a worldwide collapse, Spain's government actually didn't have a deficit. Portugal had a little bit of one. Ireland didn't have a deficit. It's the result of this economic crisis that they didn't cause that has created the problems that they're having. But in a place like Greece, there you have a situation where you've had, governments since the late mid-70s when they threw out the last military dictatorship in Greece, governments that have used patronage machines and have used things like devaluing the Greek currency in order to fund that patronage machine, that basically have overspent. And the bill finally came due on them because the lenders finally said, you know what, we're not sure we're going to get paid back by you, and we're not going to lend you any more money unless we charge outrageous rates of interest. So at that point, Greece, I mean, no one's forcing them to borrow more money. They could stop borrowing, but if they did that, then a lot of people who are get their jobs through the government are going to lose a lot of jobs. So it's a fairly delicate situation. To just simply blame it on the banks is just not taking stock of the entire picture in which Greece really has run up a bill that now people aren't willing to lend them money for anymore. And in fact, the people who are lending the money are the other European countries like Germany and France and others who basically have taken Greece off the bond markets. They've given Greece loans at about a 5% interest rate, which is about a third of what Greece would pay if they went out onto the bonds markets and tried to borrow money for the usual way that countries borrow these things. So, it's – and the other thing that I think you have to keep in mind is that they do owe money to Greek and French and British and even U.S. banks. But those are – people have to pay their bills just like we have to pay our bills at some point. If Greece were to simply say, we're not going to pay you, then no one's going to loan the money anymore, and then they would basically have to start laying off massive amounts of people more than they've already done. So Greece is really in a difficult situation, and it's going to take them quite a few years to get out of that with the help of their fellow European countries who are helping them out. So I don't see that it's just simply a case of blaming the banks in the case of Greece.
Well, it's not a case of blaming the banks because it's clear that in Greece there's a lot of moral hazard in terms of people not paying their taxes. And the last conservative government that ran up all these huge debts, and we know that Goldman Sachs helped them disguise their sovereign debt through all kinds of currency games that were played. So there's plenty of blame to go around, but my sense is that a lot of the European banks are deeply exposed, particularly the German banks, and these bailout packages seem to be to the banks, not to the countries.
Well, they're to the countries to pay off their lenders.
Right.
And so, if they didn't pay off their lenders, those lenders are not going to lend them any more money, and then they would have to lay off even more people.
Right. So it's the same lenders who owed the money, right?
Right. But, I mean, you know, the lenders, I mean, the banks in Europe were also looking at the same AAA bond ratings that the credit rating agencies like Standard & Poor's and Moody's and Fitch's gave to derivatives and credit default swaps that were completely, turns out, to be risky investments, and they had AAA ratings. So a lot of people got stuck as a result of the failure of the regulatory regime that started at Wall Street, started in the United States, and spread around the world. So keep in mind, again, that these banks, these German banks, these French banks, they're holding the deposits of Germans, average everyday Germans, and, you know, mom and pop small and medium-sized businesses. If they were to go under, it would have repercussions back to Germany. So it's or to France or to Britain or wherever. It's just not as simply the case of, you know, the banks against the little people. I think it's more complex than that. But I think that ultimately what we're seeing is that Europe is trying to decide how much of a fiscal union or transfer union do we want to be? And these are not easy questions to settle. For example, here in the United States, California, where we all live, if Alabama or Mississippi run short of money, they can get money from Washington, D.C. that's come from a state like California, which ran surpluses for many years. And in fact, California for decades has been, you know, net transferring money. If you look at the amount of money that in federal taxes that go from Californians to Washington, D.C., and then how much we get back about 70 to 75 cents on the dollar for every dollar we send to Washington, D.C. Well, where does that other 25 cents go? It goes to Mississippi, Alabama, Wyoming, Alaska. A lot of them are red states, and they get that transfer. And so, you know, that's, some people would argue that's a good way for a country, a union, to operate. But you think of it from the point of view of the Germans, and they're thinking, like, wait a minute, do we want to be in this position of California where we're going to be bailing out Greece and Portugal for the next two or three decades? I'm not surprised that they're not just immediately plunging in and saying, yeah, sure, we'll do that, no problem. They're taking their time to think this thing through. So what I'm saying is that these issues are not going to be solved overnight. There's no reason to expect that they should be solved overnight. Europe is in the process of becoming more of a union, of a fiscal and transfer union, but it's going to take time. I would say it's going to take a good 10 years for them to settle these issues and figure out how tight of a fiscal and transfer union they want to be. And if you look back at America in 1789, and even before that in 1780 with the Articles of Confederation, we went through a very similar process when we were deciding how much of a union do we want to be. And in fact, it took about 80 years until after the American Civil War for America to really cease being a collection of regions and to become really a nation in many, many ways, politically, economically, and such. So there's no reason to expect that Europe is going to solve these things anytime soon. And the headlines that we're seeing are just simply ideological, patriotic. Americans love to bash Europe, have always loved to bash Europe. I mean, some of the headlines I have in my book, you know, I mean, in fact, I have one that's really quite interesting from November 2006 that was in Newsweek International. And it talks about how the European economy was actually passing the American economy in terms of jobs, growth, all these sorts of things. And yet that article, and that was a cover story in Newsweek International, that article never appeared in Newsweek Domestic because, you know, they don't want Americans to know these sorts of things. So this is just, I think you really can't go by the headlines that we're seeing today. You have to really look at the longer-term trajectory.
Well, just in closing then, Stephen Hill, the North-South divide that is evident now where it's the northern European countries, particularly Germany, that are bailing out the southern European countries. And clearly the people in Germany are, as you say, are given pause and they're wondering whether this is going to go on forever. And we've had the recent example of Iceland just basically reneging on their debts, because what happens is the banks loan profitably, and then the countries, as you mentioned earlier, like Ireland, gets stuck with the sovereign debt, or it becomes attached to their sovereign debt. So, just in closing, what's your sense of Germany's long term prospects? Better than ours?
Well, I think that all the developed countries right now are trying to figure out how do we develop our economies and keep them growing and produce the wealth that we need without relying on these asset bubbles, whether it's stock market, housing, these sorts of unsustainable economies that eventually explode. And how do we do it without hyper-consumerism, because consumerism drives about 70% of the American economy, and yet now in this era of global climate change and pumping carbon into the environment, we know that if our consumerism is too high, it's just going to contribute to more carbon in the environment. So how do we do it without relying so much on hyper-consumerism? How do we do it in a way that's ecologically sustainable? These are the big challenges that all the countries, developing countries, developed as well as developing countries of the world face. And when you look at it from that point of view, it's just clear to me that Germany, France, Sweden, countries of Europe are doing far more towards really trying to address these issues on multiple levels than we're doing here in the United States. And in fact, in many ways, the United States is the outlier. Australia, Japan, Canada are doing more to really look at these hard, hard issues than we're doing in the United States. And so I really think that in some ways, from the American perspective, it looks like things are falling apart. But in other places around the world, they're in the process of taking stock of this new era, the post-economic crisis, ecological sustainability era that we're now in, and saying, how are we going to meet this and preserve our standards of living? And they're doing it in a much more forthright way than we are here in the United States. So I feel less optimistic about America
than
about other places.
Sure, and not only are we not addressing these issues, we're not even agreeing that they're real. I mean, the Republican leading contender for president, Rick Perry, saying that none of these problems exist, like climate change. So we are definitely going back into a know-nothing kind of Stone Age mentality. I think
one thing I'd say, Ian, is that I think Winston Churchill, if to paraphrase him, he kind of got it right. He said, America always does the right thing after it's done everything else first. And so I think in some ways we're going to come along after other countries figure out what's their best way to go. And, I do think America, we have a lot of strengths, a lot of things that we can rely on in order to move ourselves forward. But right now we are definitely paralyzed and having a hard time figuring out what's the way forward.
Well, again, I thank you for joining us, Stephen Hill.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Stephen Hill, who is a writer, columnist, and former director of the Political Reform Program at the New America Foundation. His books include 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy, Fixing Elections, The Failure of American Winner-Take-All Politics, and Whose Vote Counts. His latest book is Europe's Promise, Why the European Way is the Best Hope for an Insecure Age. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again on Sunday with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.